seem to have descended into some sort of dark hole there. missed the 20-minute mark by a few minutes. Well, I was thinking, you know, about this invitation I got, and it brings up these questions for me. Is this question: would you be willing to present on how to integrate mindfulness practices and theory within 12-step recovery pathways in addiction recovery? And my kind of go, what? It's the language of it, this clinical language. I don't understand, really. But in mindfulness theory, you know, I've over the years had a good number of opportunities to make these kind of presentations. These people in the waiting room are okay. I recognize their names. Yeah, I'm sorry I didn't mention the day. It's June 3rd, Tuesday. We had a little invasion of from the manosphere, boys being boys, so we got a little off to a bumpy start. It's interesting that they chose racist names as their screen names, too. I lost my track there, sorry. The idea of, mindfulness and the 12 steps, it's like, I don't know if I've ever mentioned this, but one breath at a time, after I had signed a contract to publish One Breath at a Time, the editor asked me if I wanted to or would change the subtitle from Buddhism and the 12 Steps to Mindfulness and the 12 Steps. And the book was published in 2004, which means this was probably in 2003. It would have been in 2003. And I was not tempted to change the title. And it's a really important distinction in my mind. You know, Buddhism is this body of knowledge, and more than just knowledge, it's, as you know, like practices and insights and ideas and ways of dissecting experience in the human mind and the human experience, along with, moral guidelines. And, I've been going through Bhikkhu Bodhi's book on the social and communal aspects of Buddhist teachings. And, there's nothing about meditation in it. It's all about the Buddha talking about how to live in society, and so the idea of just taking mindfulness and, never had an appeal to me. And of course, the reason they like that in these both academic and publishing worlds is that they, particularly in the publishing world, they see it as a way to reach a broader audience, that they think, oh, Buddhism, people are going to have projections about what that means. And, if they're Christian, they won't want to be interested into it, or they'll think it's some kind of exotic, mystical thing, all that sort of stuff, which I think, frankly, don't care about. bless them all, let them think whatever they want. But it's simply, my little quick line about the difference between, or about like taking mindfulness as a separate aspect of the and sort of leaving out the rest of the path, is that it's like taking the vitamin C out of an orange and giving someone a pill and saying, here's your breakfast. The nutrition is there, but if you don't get the juice and the pulp and all the rest of it, you're not going to be very satisfied. In fact, it's not going to do the job. And I have questions about what's even happening with the mindfulness movement. I've sensed encountered a fair amount of disappointment when it comes to mindfulness as, this all-purpose cure-all, I get the sense that many people are disappointed when they are introduced to mindfulness with all these promises, and then they sit down and try to pay attention to their breath, and they find themselves spacing out the whole time, and then they're like, well, what's this? This isn't working, And many of you guys are very experienced practitioners and have been on retreats and certainly at least been sitting with me for a long time. And you know that this is a long-term training that takes a great deal of patience and endurance and persistence, and that it's simply not a fix. It's not something that you just take a six-week MBSR course and great, got it now. It really takes work, and there are many dimensions and many challenges, and there's you have to get a very broad picture. And the only way you develop that broad picture is by trying it over and over again. And not just doing the sitting over and over again, right? But also reflecting on the teachings in your life, in different situations in your life. Doing the kind of reflection that the 12 steps recommend, like at the end of the day, kind of, well, how did that go? And where did I slip up? And where did that work? It takes a lot of practice. And the meditation itself is a very subtle process that, I sometimes feel that that after 45 years of doing this practice, I don't really know how to do it or how it works or whatever. I just show up, and remarkably, I do find that I get benefit from it virtually every time. But again, the benefit isn't quite maybe what it's marketed to be. And when we try to put the whole process into clinical terms, it just becomes problematic. It's not a clinical experience, it's simply not. And it's not really measurable in those terms. This is just totally my opinion. So that sort of makes me think, well, let's ask this question. Well, what is mindfulness, right? And that question itself is a difficult one to nail down. This word sati, which we translate as mindfulness, it has nothing. The word mindfulness was plucked out of the air by some 19th century English colonist linguist who probably had never really meditated. And sati, S-A-T-I, which is the word in Pali that we translate as mindfulness, is about memory. And so then we have Bhikkhu Anālayo saying that, you know, if you're mindful, you will remember things that you did when you were mindful. And I'm like, I don't even know what you're talking about. Like, what is that? So, you know, we've come to understand that it's something about, and there is some language of it, some of it sort of clinical, about attentional training, you know, training your attention to focus on the present moment. But it's not just the present moment, right? There's this broader process, because mindfulness actually is very interested in cause and effect. And cause and effect, by definition, means that you're paying attention to more than the present moment. Because if there's a cause and an effect, they're not in the same moment. And so mindfulness asks us to have this kind of big picture in some ways of, like, what is the process by which things happen? What is the process by which emotions arise, thoughts appear, you know, clinging happens, suffering, dukkha? How does all this happen, and how do we, you know, how does it pass? And then, you know, and then we see that, like, the Buddha points to these four different areas of experience, you know, body, feeling, mental formations, dhammas. Well, each of them, including body, is quite complex in the way it's presented in the teachings. And it doesn't really lend itself to a... It's not modern, you know. It doesn't fit with our modern way of thinking about either the mind or experience, or even what we should pay attention to, because there it is under the body. The Buddha says you should go to the charnel ground and watch dead bodies in different at different stages of decay. Well, that's not something that you hear in the MBSR class, right? Like, but there it is. It's like right in this critical sutta, and obviously there's a reason why the Buddha said that, right? We can draw out that this is about non-attachment and non-sensuality and not clinging to the body as self and all this stuff. It's complicated, right? It doesn't lend itself to sort of, oh, just pay attention to your breath and you'll become, you'll develop equanimity. You know, like, okay, yeah, that's a helpful tool, but there's so much more to it, right? And I've been, you know, talking a lot lately about Vedana, the second foundation of mindfulness, which again is not something that is even, that we even have a concept of in the English language. So Bhikkhu Bodhi calls it the affective tone or the hedonic quality. But, you know, I just gave a talk at James Barras' group last week, and I gave the same talk at Big Bear the previous weekend about how Vedana's role in the three different lists in the foundations of mindfulness, in the five aggregates, and in the dependent origination, and trying to show why the Buddha made this one of the four things to pay attention to. Like, that's giving it a lot of weight. Say it's 25% of what we should pay attention to is Vedana. And so first we have to learn what Vedana is and become capable of identifying it in our experience, since it's not something that we've ever been told even existed, much less how to pay attention to it. So this takes some time. And then when we see, oh, Vedana, it's in the four foundations as something we should pay attention to, but the Buddha doesn't say why we should pay attention to it there. It's only in these two other lists that it becomes clear why. And it's two distinct reasons. One is that Vedana is in the five aggregates, Vedana leads to, actually, let me do the dependent origination first. In the dependent origination, Vedana leads to craving. You know, pleasant Vedana leads to desire, unpleasant Vedana leads to aversion, neutral Vedana leads to delusion. So greed, hatred, and delusion are triggered by the different kinds of affective tone we're experiencing. Well, that's really important, right? Because we can see, like, that's where suffering really gets set off. That's the whole kind of nexus of suffering. I just threw out that word nexus. I think it's a good word, you know. And so then when we look at the aggregates, Vedana is followed by perception. So feeling leads to perception. So when we have a feeling, we name it. That's my understanding of what those words refer to. So we label it. We have a feeling and we label it. And I've been talking a lot about this, right? How the labels that we put on our experience, particularly on our emotions or the feelings we're having that we call emotions, those labels have a big impact on how we create more stories and then fall into a belief system and get caught and locked into one viewpoint of things because we think that a particular feeling is something. We give it an identity, which the aggregates are all about identity. As the Buddha teaches about the aggregates, it's all about how we create identity out of this. So just, you know, without trying to make that particular point, what I'm talking about, what I'm getting at is that when you say, oh, mindfulness and the 12 steps, you're like, I'm not sure you know what you're asking for because it's complicated, right? It is very complicated. And it's not, you know, what I'm asked for, but in these settings, and again, I've been, you know, presented in various different conferences and things, and I've never felt comfortable, and I've never felt that I did a good job, and I've never felt that anybody was particularly happy with what I presented, and sometimes I know that sounds like, oh, you're just negative about yourself, and some of that may be true, but I have actually gotten pretty clear responses at times that, like, what I was offering was not what they wanted. And I get that because therapists want therapies. That they want me to show them a therapy that they can apply to their patients. And I'm more of a direct-to-consumer business here. I like to work with addicts and help them to work with their stuff. I don't know how to tell somebody how to do what I do. I mean, you know, you guys know me enough that it's like, what does Kevin Griffin do? He sits there and talks about shit. I don't know, but it's kind of cool. I don't know. It resonates for me, right? I mean, what I offer is me is this, like, it's what a Buddhist teacher does. A Buddhist teacher tries to be present and transmit something. Well, you can't teach that how to do that. You know, you can't, especially not a therapist, especially since I'm not a therapist. You know, And I have no training in that field. And I'm, in fact, repelled by the language and culture of it. I mean, I was looking at some... I'm sorry, guys. I hope you'll forgive me for this morning, and we can delete this recording, I think. But I was looking at some of the research that they've done at this center at Harvard that's inviting me to speak. And one of them referred to this thing. I've seen it before, and it just... like, it's called adverse childhood experiences. And the therapists here probably know this, ACEs, you know, and I see that and I go, oh, come on. Now being a child becomes a pathology, right? Adverse childhood experiences that, I mean, I'm sure you've all had them, you know, but the fact that it's like gets its own acronym just drives me crazy. And, you know, of course, it's important. You know, it's great. You know, that we need to address all those ACEs. But I just can't. So anyway, this was a difficult morning. And so getting bombed at the beginning of the class. Some of you came in later, don't know that. We had some children trying to... you know, I don't know what they're trying to do, just have their fun. I guess it's like the end of the semester, maybe they're getting, school is out. But I'm also a little bit of a slightly under the weather, weirdly almost, not sick, but not quite perfect. So there we go, Tricycle Magazine's Sati meeting. Thank you, Monica. Great. So I have some time left if anybody wants to speak into this space. You are more than welcome. Thank you. Now I want to read the Tricycle article, though. What does this say? Who is it? Oh, Andy Alensky. Sure. Well, he's good. Wants me to log in. I think I do have a login. I did. Look at that. Anyway, anybody want to, please go ahead. Pam, hi.
I just want to be clear. Did you say a couple minutes ago that you are not perfect?
I don't remember saying that, but
I
know that
the weather, and you're not really under the weather, but you're not perfect.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. I'm just teasing. Sorry.
That's all you have to say? Oh, well, that was imperfect. So thank you, Pam. Is there anyone else? Abigail is waving.
Good morning. Good morning. I couldn't find the thing to put up.
That's fine. It's fine.
I was struck when you were talking about what you do, what a Buddhist teacher does. It's exactly what an old timer in AA does for a newcomer.
Hmm. Yeah.
We don't teach. We don't tell them how to fix anything. Well, some people do, but
yeah.
In its purest form, we just say, this is my experience. This is what I have learned, and I'd love to give it to you if you can make use of it.
Yeah.
And thank you for doing that for us.
Yeah. Thanks, Abigail. Deborah.
Hi. I think that mindfulness is just a buzzword right now.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
I think that it's... really kind of points to more like the divine abodes, and it's kind of ironic that it uses the core word mind, because it really centers more around the heart.
Yeah.
And getting people out of the mind into the heart and thinking awareness and loving kindness and equanimity and maybe it's like sympathetic joy,
mm-hmm.
and just more all-encompassing of others than being up here in the head.
Yeah.
And I think that's what the world well, at least our society thinks when they hear that word mindfulness, you know, not traumatic or what was the childhood experience?
Yeah, right. Adverse childhood experiences. Yeah.
Like they all have them.
Yeah, really.
I was thinking of like my puppy, you know, he had a traumatic puppy experience, but he's in recovery now.
Very good. Thank you. Monica.
Couple of things. One of them is that I had the opportunity to catch up with my friend who's of East or Indian origin, who's now a part-time professor at Cambridge. And she, when she was a child, her father died, and she just was talking about the charnel, like with her uncle, they were meditating. And I was like, wow, that's the second time I've heard that. But so I thought that was really interesting. And she has some, she's in recovery, and she also does some Buddhist stuff. So we had a lot of we have always had a lot in common. But I was, what struck me was, there's been some good comments, but I don't know why our society has taught us to be so highly let's analyze everything. You know, like, and I hear people say, well, is this the first John? Is this the second John? Is the, you know, all in excited about something. And I'm like, just stay. And the other buzzword I heard when I was on this trip was about the Mandalorian. This is the way. This is, maybe it's as simple as that. This is the way. And I have a sponsor. I'm always saying, you know, look in your own shopping basket. I see people always looking in other people's shopping basket. You know, like, okay, they're mindful. They're not. You know, let's put everybody in these little boxes, you know. So yeah, so anyway, that's it. Otherwise I'm gonna start to drift off too, but believe it or not, I think you had some good things to say. So
believe it or not.
Well, you don't, you think you're whatever, you know.
No, I you know, I can feel when I start to roll, and it's like, oh, this is starting to get good. Yeah, and part of it is my, you know, whatever, negativity that people accuse me of. But thank you. So I see Paolo has his hand up.
Hello, everyone. I'm at work and don't have the greatest connection, so I don't have my video on. I apologize. Yeah, Kevin. You put your finger on the pulse of something that's vital, and I think it's very easy to make the mistake of perceiving something that may be manifesting wrongly in some respects. And you know, reifying it, and then what, speaking of buzzwords, is reify.
Yeah.
And then leaving it at that, or viewing something from only its wholesome or healthy side, and reifying that and seeing it only from that. And there's a great book out there by Gil Fronsdale, What's Wrong with Mindfulness, and then subtitled in parentheses, What's Right with It. And I think it's what we do as a society. You know, we did it with yoga. We've done it with martial arts. Yeah. We can leak the spirituality or depth out of something. And it's not one thing or another, right? Like I know people who are non-Buddhist who have taken mindfulness and have really done something powerful and healthy with it in their lives. Mm-hmm. And then there's the aspect of it where it's been commodified and it's being sold to us. And Buddhism itself is a buzzword, and there's no escaping it. And I remember years ago, I had an opportunity to meet some bigwig at the University of Pennsylvania, and everyone kept telling me how lucky I was to meet him. And I was just like, yeah, whatever. You know, I'm sure I've had these kind of things before as a kid growing up in New York City, and most people end up being disappointing. Then I met him, and I could tell that he was deeply wounded in a way, you know, that he had his own mental illness, and he said one wise thing after another, and I really did feel blessed. And I remember him saying one thing, which is that the academic world is very trendy to begin with, and there's no academic discipline more trendier than psychology, and that there's always a kind of hot new diagnosis, and at that time it might have been ADD. And then it was, you know, before that it was manic depression, which became bipolar. And after that it was trauma. So it's like if everything is trauma, nothing is trauma.
Yeah.
And you have to respect people who've been traumatized by a single incident, but also acknowledge the fact that it's vitally important for someone. Everyone's grown up in a dysfunctional family, but that's much different than growing up in a family in complete chaos. Everyone's had adverse childhood experiences, but if you've had an adverse childhood experience, it's powerful to be diagnosed with that in the same way that it is with alcoholism. You know, everyone's been beat up or spanked too hard or something or other, but not everyone's been, and to even bring these things up is almost in polite company, but not everyone's been sexually abused.
Right.
Everyone was ritually beaten. Not everyone had parents who disappeared for a week to 3 weeks at a time because they went on runs. And there's a big difference between kind of ordinary dysfunction and just complete chaos. And it is, and thankfully is very powerful that these things are being acknowledged. But there's the danger of everything is overanalyzed and over diagnosed. Like suddenly everyone who's going through a difficult period is officially depressive. There's a world of difference between like ordinary depression that any adult knows and chronic depression that is the equivalent of addiction. I don't quite know how to wrap it up. It's not something that can be wrapped up in some like cute way. And I appreciate the fact that you don't reify your teaching and make it into something official. Although there's something in place for that. And the way that you speak to us is very human and I appreciate it. And I'm not quite sure what the hell I'm saying.
I appreciate Paolo. I mean, particularly what I'm hearing is like, there are conditions, there are things that can legitimately be called pathologies. And there's a way in which, just as you said, like, you know, everything becomes a pathology, everything is trauma, you know, and I just go back to the first noble truth, that there is dukkha, and that there is suffering, that we all have suffering, and just as you point out, there are horrendous levels of suffering that really deserve a whole other kind of attention and care. I mean, that's what, you know, war and the horrors that are out there are. And it's a whole other dimension, far off from our ordinary daily lives. We've run past 11 o'clock, and you got me intrigued tonight about the book What's Wrong with Mindfulness. And I see that Gil has it looks like he has an essay in it. It seems to be a collection of essays on that topic, because it didn't show up as one of his books. It says it's Robert Rosenbaum as editor and Barry Magid. Those are two editors. But then it says Gil, Franz Dermack, Erdstein thoughtfully explored the rich Pali roots of mindfulness. So anybody who's looking for it, there you go. So thank you all for showing up. I had a very busy May, and I have a very unbusy June. So I will be trying to take it more easy. I will be the only places I will be besides here on Tuesday mornings next Tuesday. A week from today, I will be at the Berkeley Buddhist Monastery in person in the evening, 7:30. And then the following Friday, I will be online for Spirit Rock. And that's it for the month. So hope to see you here or there. Thank you all.
Namaste.
Thank you, Kevin. Appreciate the thoughts on mindfulness and the present moment. That was very interesting. Good conversation.
Thank you.
Thanks, Kevin.
All right. Thanks, nice Monica. You, great Monica. To have you back. Yeah.
Kevin, get better.
Good yeah, job, Monica. Thanks.
Cheers, Monica.
Welcome home.
Thanks, Kevin.
Enjoy your golfing.
Thank you.
Yeah, got to do golf. Go golf.